them. So I started running after them, wanting to ask why. At which time, somebody who was connected with, who sort of knew the Russian system better than I and so forth, said, "Don't dare. In Russia, you don't ask why, because you will be taken too." I couldn't understand it. First of all, I was much younger and I was inexperienced. So I didn't at the time, but I really didn't think it was serious. We were very well known in town, and we had connections all over, and was no problem with anybody will go over and explain my father is not a spy and he is not an enemy of the system, and that will be that. But what happened instead? We got word that my mother and I better go into hiding. So my mother and I went into hiding, but someone came and told my grandmother that they were going to take the prisoners out of that prison and take them to Sambor, which was a middle-sized town. Between Lemberg and my hometown, that they were going to take them there, so does the police say, but possibly to Russia or to Siberia or wherever, or maybe even to, execute them. But nobody knew any reason why. So my grandmother sent my uncle. I had an uncle who was living with my grandmother. She sent him over to see what happened. By the time he came to the police, he was told that everybody's already at the railroad station. He went to the railroad station, at which time my father and brother were already in the train, we were told, and he was taken back to the police station. This was a few weeks prior to the deal that Russia made with, wait a minute, this was before they, no, not the deal. This was before the Germans were moving eastward and the Russians were retreating. And of course, as the Russians were retreating, they were getting stricter and stricter. And then the Germans were already close to our hometown. This was when the love affair ended between Russia and Germany. And the Germans were already close to our hometown. And one day the Russians entered. For all we knew,
You mean the Germans
the
entered?
Germans entered. For all we knew was, we didn't know where father and brother are at that point, but we thought. But we knew that uncle was at the police. The Russians retreated. The Ukrainians broke into the prison and into the basement. And in the basement, they found a few corpses. Without trying to identify who the corpses were, they ran out outraged. And of course, usually the Jews had their stores, like in the center of town, the little stores that they had, and this is where they usually lived downtown. They started knocking on doors and windows and so forth, and pulling Jews out and beating them and so on. In the meantime, back in prison, somebody identified the bodies, and identified among the bodies Jonathan Wind, and that was my uncle. At which point there was a very prominent Ukrainian physician in town. He was also a family friend. He stood up on something. I don't know, I wasn't there because my mother and I at that point were in hiding. We were told he stood up and over a loudspeaker said to the mob, "Stop it. The Jews didn't do it," because the mob said the Jews did it, the Jewish communists did it. They killed these people. He said, "You know Jews didn't do it. The best proof is that among the victims is a Jew. The Russians did it before they left, before they ran away." So, according to eyewitnesses of that time, and we discussed it again in Israel this past summer when I was there and I met people from my hometown, the fact of the discovery of my uncle's body prevented a pogrom in my hometown. They all contended that the local population would have wiped out the local Jews after they found the bodies. So then they sent, the Ukrainians, sent for my grandmother and said, go recognize your son. He was mutilated. His eyes were pulled out, his tongue was cut off, he was mutilated.
And the Russians?
And the Russians, as far as we know, the Russians did it. The Germans could not have done it yet because they weren't in yet. And we doubt that the local population had done it yet. He had a funeral. And the strange twist of fate, this uncle was not a religious man. My father was very Orthodox. I have another uncle who was in Israel, and he was an ardent Zionist, and he went there at a very young age. But the other uncle who was left there was not a religious person. And even though he had been married, he never wanted to wear his talus. As fate would want it, it was destined. When they found him, and my grandmother came, and I was told she did not become emotional, she didn't shed a tear, she just made the necessary blessing, and she said, well, now I will go home and get his talus. And so this man, who never wanted to use it, had a religious Jewish funeral, indeed the very last religious funeral in my hometown. For all we know, he was the last Jew buried on the Jewish cemetery in my hometown. The next day, the Germans entered. And of course, that is another chapter. Now the Germans came in, and my mother and I, since I'm speaking about my private life now, and then I'll speak about the general, my mother and I came out of hiding. The terrible irony of it, that we were in hiding prior to the Germans, and now the Germans came in, and we came out of hiding. Nobody in town believed that anything as tragic will happen. Tragic is not the word. We figured life would be tough, but nothing as what happened. But we came out and thinking, wondering where father and brother are, whether they are still anywhere in Poland or are they in Russia, whatever. And then one day, a young boy came running into the house and said, Mr. Wind and Hesher were seen walking on the bridge outside town. So I remember running out of the house and toward them to greet my father and brother. Then they came home and they told us what happened. They had been in this prison in Sambor all these weeks. And they had heard bombing, they had heard shooting, they knew something, that a change of hands was taking place. And they were wondering what would happen. He said there were a lot of prisoners, and they figured they might destroy the prison with the people in it and so forth, that they wouldn't bother transporting them at this point. And father was telling the following story. One guard remembered that my father had a watch And the Russians were known for being very, very greedy for anything at all, but watches especially. And so when they were given an order to dynamite, to blow up the prison, and for them to escape, this particular guard, remember that in that cell, I used to remember the number of the cell, now I don't, that in that cell there is a man who has a watch. And before he runs away, before he blows up the prison, he is going to get that watch. You know, sometimes when I recall or relate these stories, I myself think that they sound incredible. They sound incredible to me too. And so he ran in and ran over to my father and said, "Give me the watch." And as father told the story, he was so excited, he was so thrilled with that watch that he ran out and didn't lock the cell. As somebody, another prisoner from another cell was screaming, "Let's break the cells open, let's break the cells open," somebody walked over to this, whatever it was, I suppose a grated door, and he found it open. They walked out into the hallway, and then they opened up other cells. You know, sometimes I watch television. I don't watch anything that's fiction, but true stories I watch. And sometimes I see this, you know, a cell or people breaking out. And they broke out. And later, when I'll be telling you the story how I escaped from Weisenhofer prison, it's very similar to some extent. So they, all the prisoners broke out. Later on, people contacted my father, thanking him that due to him, they all left the prison. They left the prison, but the Germans were already in Sambor, and the Ukrainians were really all along the way. They were being very mean, and they were hurting people and destroying people in the villages and small towns and so forth. So they walked at night. They didn't take any public transportation. They walked at night through the woods from Sambor to a town called Starosambor, meaning Old Sambor. And there we had an uncle and an aunt. And they stayed there for another few days, and then they made their way back home again through the night and so forth. And somehow they made it. When the Germans came in, my father's thinking was that since he had been a Russian prisoner, which obviously indicates that he was not a communist sympathizer, that he is not the enemy of the Germans or whatever, that there's no reason, that there is no reason for him to be immediately persecuted by the Germans. So as it happened, the first few days, yes, some of the local people did take up for my father, and they said to him that he had a name in town, the most honest, the most respected Jew in town. He prided himself on that title. And I sincerely, what he and what the rest of us felt that is they simply needed him. So as it happened, in the beginning, things were so okay. I was, of course, at home, and both mother and I had our hair cut almost to the skin. We were
Why?
forced to work because Jewish women didn't wear, long hair was out of the question. It depended on the local authority. In some places they shaved them off, of course in concentration camps and ghettos they did, but even before ghettos and concentration camps, in some towns the order was to shave off everybody's hair, men and women and children.
Jews?
Jews,
Just
of course,
Jews?
Jews, yeah,
The Germans have short
and
hair.
others, yeah. And at first I only had a man's hairstyle. I always had long hair. I remember even until not long ago, I wore my hair long. But I cut it at first very short. But then one day, a friend of the family, a Ukrainian friend of the family, came over and said to my parents that I still look too good. And I was young, I was fairly good looking, and I was fairly, and I wasn't wearing rags yet, and that I should shave off my hair and sort of, you know, put on some old clothes and so forth, which I did. At first, I worked as a cleaning girl for a man who had an office. He was a friend of the family. But then things got worse, and my mother and I worked on the road splitting rocks. And father worked in his trade. I truly believe that the reason we were still alive for as long as we were was that they needed my father. So we were. My brother, he, as I said, was handicapped. Again, the same thing. The handicapped people went first, of course. You know, hunchbacks had no right to live in the first place. So had they not needed him and my father, they would have taken him right away. But in the beginning, the actions were, you know what the term action means, you know what action means. An action was a killing. An action meant, action or akcja in Polish, it meant gathering up whomever they can find at that particular time, within the time that the action is to take place. In other words, if the directives came from above that an action takes place from 8 to 3, let's say, that then on the dot at 8 o'clock, the German police and their Ukrainian and Polish henchmen would all run out of the police headquarters into the streets and grab whatever Jew was in the street and then break into whatever doors they could, into whatever houses they could, and get the people out. And depending on the directives of the day, whether the shooting will take place on the spot or they'll be taken by buses into a gathering place or whatever. But after 3 o'clock, you were safe. And this could take place during the day, it could take place at night, it could be a Sunday, it could be a weekday, it could be summer, it could be winter. There seemed to be no specific logic to any of this. I remember witnessing the first action myself. I mean, there had been actions prior to that, to the extent that we heard something was happening, we would lock all the doors. And then when it was quiet, when we listened in, it was quiet, and we peeked in through the window, and we saw already like a Jew. You know, when I teach the Bible, and I teach the story of Noah, how he sent out the dove to see if there was stepping ground yet, this is how we would do. First, you know, from this, I remember we had a small crack and a board in the attic, and through that crack we would look around to see if anybody is daring to step out yet from the hiding. And so when we saw somebody, then we knew the action is over, then we are safer until the next action.
You never would consider going into hiding now.
So let me just talk about this one action. And the first action that I witnessed, that I knew it was going to be an action, was I was opening, it was a morning, it was a Sunday, and to go to church, to the Roman Catholic Church, you had to go through our street, past our house. And of course it was Sunday morning, a beautiful Sunday morning, it was July, and the July action was the biggest in my hometown. It's recorded here in this book. It was the largest. I wish I had a chance to take a peek into it prior to your coming. The last time I looked at it was the first time I got it, which is like 10 or 15 years ago. I have not opened it since. The action, I had, people were going to church. It was a beautiful, and they all dressed up. I mean, the local population lived a perfectly normal life, as if nothing was taking place whatsoever. It did not concern them whatsoever, except perhaps perhaps for the very few exceptional individuals who did feel or who did commiserate or who would have liked to help. But by and large, the majority of the population was totally unaffected. So it was, I believe,
I'm going to have to change my tape again. Sorry.
You asked me a question, so... I don't have it on yet, so take your time.
Oh.
All right, so you and your mother were working in the streets, I think.
Oh, right. Okay, no, that's right. We are ready with the Germans, right. So, yes, we were going to work, and the rules came gradually. At first, Jews could not hold the positions that they held. For instance, I'll never forget it. I used to have a high school teacher, a Jewish teacher, who taught German, German literature and so forth. I happened to dislike him very much because I often felt that the reason he didn't treat me well in high school was because he was Jewish and I was Jewish, and it was reverse discrimination. He leaned backwards not to give the impression to the rest of the class that he's treating me nicely. He probably thought that when the Germans will come in, he, having been a German professor, that he would have special consideration. Well, unfortunately, his father and mother and sisters were taken very early. When I bumped into him one way on the way to work, my mother and I, we bumped into him. He didn't look anything like the professor he was prior to that. He was just one of us. He was a Jew. If there was one thing that Hitler did, was to once again establish that a Jew is a Jew is a Jew in the eyes of the outsider, certainly. Regardless, we have known it, and the study of anti-Semitism has shown it. There's really no specific reason or cause why one hates a Jew or for anti-Semitism. To say that Jews are hated because they're bankers or because they're communists, because they are highly educated, or because they are backwards, they are very universalist, or because they are parochial, there was really no rules about that. And this we found to be so under the German occupation. So we worked. We were not allowed to go on trains or certainly schools, movies, theaters, offices, banks, anything, any ordinary, everyday kind of places that human beings go to were barred to Jews. However, within our own group, life, well, there was a semblance of normal life. For instance, no, a Jew would not walk to the synagogue, but he prayed wherever he was. If he was still in his home in the beginning, then he prayed in his home. And if there were a few Jewish families walking within the kind of distance where they can walk inconspicuously to another's home, to another person's home, they tried as far as possible to still have a minyan, a quorum of 10 people. I remember the very first thing, if I may go back right now. I remember when the Russians came in. Of course, prior to the Russians, we lived a very rich cultural life. And most Jewish youth belonged to Jewish organizations, and the Jewish Zionist organizations covered the spectrum from the extreme right to the extreme left and the in-between. Yes, there was also not a Herut party. It wasn't called Herut at the time, but there was a Betar, which was the revisionist party, of which Begin is, of course, the most famous...
Begin, Prime Minister of Israel.
Prime Minister of Israel is the most famous member. So we had all these organizations, and we would meet and discuss. I often wonder why today's youth seems to need something like that. They have to have either a dance or a ball game or whatever. Why can they not meet for intellectual reasons? Do you understand? I mean, youth meeting to discuss world's problems. It just doesn't happen here. It was the normal thing to do at home. And then when the war broke out, I remember the first time a friend came running and said, we have to liquidate our organization and we have to bury all our papers. It was a middle-of-the-road Zionist organization. It was called Akiba. And I remember it was during the night, we gathered up the membership list and whatever documents we had, books about Palestine, maps and so forth, and we buried them. And I've often thought that someday I'd like to still go back and bury them. So now the Germans are there, and food is getting scarcer. And I remember I was, it came back the other day, that thought came back. Father always complained that his stomach hurts, but he only complained about it when it came time to eat. There was very little food, of course. We were more fortunate than the others because Father, in return for repairing a watch, he would get, let's say, a pound of flour or some potatoes or whatever from the peasants surrounding villages. And I remember Mother always worrying, my God, I'm already at the last few ounces of flour. I was telling the story to Sherry the other day. I'm on the last few ounces of flour. Her father would say, don't worry. God will help that before this few ounces is finished, somebody's going to come with a watch, and we are going to have something to eat. And it was always at mealtime that Father complained his stomach hurt. And then I became wiser why his stomach always hurt. He couldn't eat. There was only this much bread, you know. He felt, no, I can't have it because my stomach hurts. You have it. And I would say, no, I can't have it for whatever reason. Mother have it. And this would go like between the four of us. Well, we were still all four together. It was the same with work. I often wanted to replace Mother at work, but it was impossible because the numbers were counted, you see. We were not in a camp and we were not in a ghetto. We still lived in our own home, but we had to go to work. There was a Judenrat already, and the Judenrat had to deliver a number of people to work. And so we went to work, and then you had to be very fortunate to still have a semblance of physical
strength,
which was no issue with me, but with Mother. She seemed to be taking things very, very hard from the very beginning. And now I'll tell you a few stories how we escaped a few actions. And I'll tell you something which I don't think I've ever told anybody, including my own family, or even my uncle in Israel. One day, we knew it was an action. Yes, that was the day. Remember I told you I opened the door and I saw, oh, I never finished that story. I opened the door and I saw a woman down the street running, a Jewish woman, of course. She was running, and I looked back up toward the hill, and up on that hill was the police, the German police. The Ukrainian police was somewhere else. The Polish police was somewhere else. The German police was up on the hill. I saw a German, revolver in hand, shooting that woman. I saw that woman fall as I closed the outside door. And I ran in and I said, let's go. It's an action. Now, from our kitchen, well, we had, it was a two-story brick house. And there was the store, and next to the store was a kitchen and a room. And upstairs, there were two rooms in the kitchen, like an apartment. And the good times, we would live there. But most of the time, times were bad. So we rented out that upstairs apartment because that money went for paying the high school. And father forever said, well, that takes top priority, you know. And so it was my dream that someday we would be able to afford to live upstairs too. So now somebody else was living upstairs, of course, and we were downstairs. And in from the kitchen, there was an entrance to a basement. Before the war, many years before the war, I remember that basement wasn't finished. It didn't have a roof. It had beams, and every time mother would go down, she'd hurt her head. And finally, one day, somehow there was this extra money, and they finished up that basement. They put a roof in that basement, so the beams didn't stick out. Okay. And the way that opened up, there was a wooden door that you lifted up and walked down into that basement. So what they decided, we decided that put a rug over that entrance to the basement. And it would be attached somehow to that door. It was a flat door. So that we go down, and as we pull down the door, that rug covers that door, and that's it. And nobody could conceive that somebody went down, and how could anybody cover up that entrance? We went down, and we were hiding. And we heard screams outside, terrible screams. And we knew what was going on. We didn't know then that it was the big action. It's now known as the big action. As we were reminiscing in Israel with some people, they knew the term, that was a big action. That was July 42. Slight digression. Prior to that, there were small actions. In other words, after an action, we would walk outside and we'd say the Mandels were taken, the Cohens were taken, the Levies were taken, this one is missing, a brother here, a father there, a child there, and so forth. So we were down in this basement, and we hear what's going on outside. And father says, I think that I ought to go out. He says, if they will find us here, they'll be very angry, and they'll kill us on the spot. He was so beautifully naive. He was so beautifully trusting. And he was so beautifully honest. He said, but if I will come out, maybe the Germans just need me. Maybe all they want is a watch to repair. And we hear them banging in the front door, banging in the back door. And he whispers, he says, let me go out. They probably want me. I'll fix their watch and nothing will happen. I put my hand on my father's mouth. And I held his hands tight. I said, no, you're not going. Either we die right here in this basement, all of us, or we live, all of us. You don't go. And he started reciting the Psalms all the time, whenever we were in hiding, whenever he knew his Psalms by heart. He recited them every day anyway. And so he recited the Tehillim, his Psalms, and suddenly, we hear our grandmother outside. She was living in a different part of town, not too far from us. How she ever made it from her house to ours is a total miracle. I believe what she did was she put a scarf around her head and a big shawl around her like the peasants would, and so nobody knew that she was Jewish. She made a net far from us, and we heard her screaming, "Children, children, where are you?" Looking for us all over. And somebody outside saying, "They must be hidden, they must be in the basement," all this in Yiddish. As we hear this, and she says, "Children, where are you?" We hear a shot. And it was just about a time when Father was again ready to open the door. We heard the shot. And by the time the action was over and we came out, we had been told that the bodies from the streets had been gathered up. And they were taken to a common grave. And that was the end of my grandmother. So there was my uncle by the Russians, my grandmother. I really don't know whether it was a German bullet or Ukrainian bullet. That was very difficult to tell because they all did it.
Was it the Germans were pounding at one door and she was coming?
She was trying to enter the back door, right. No, they finally got into the house. Wait a minute, I didn't finish. They broke the doors open. They got into the kitchen. We heard their steps over our head. They opened up every closet, the bread cabinet. We didn't have, like here you have a bread box. There was a cabinet where the bread and the flowers were standing. Now I can just see it. And the book closets, the walls were lined with book closets primarily, under the beds, everywhere. They didn't find us. I remember the feeling when we heard them walking out. We heard them screaming. We heard them screaming, "They must be here," because the doors were locked from within, which it was. "They must be here." But they were really in a hurry because if not us, there were other people available. And you see, the things had to be done within the allotted time. And they had to be, it was like what do you call it? To make the, to procure the number of the people, the quota, and the maximum people that you can get. So you're not going to fool around with one Jew or with one family when within this time you can gather up six families. So God knows how many Jews. I do want to, at this point, recall, as the memories come back, before one action, we knew, we saw it was going to be an action. And it was the middle of the day because the mailman was coming down the street. The mailman who had been delivering mail to us for as long as I remembered, it seemed like all my life. He stopped in front of the house and stood there waiting. And I remember my father asking him, "Well, what are you waiting for?" And he said, "I am waiting for after you they take you." And I remember the tremendous shock this was to my parents, to my brother and me as young people. We've known this man all our lives. He would come in, he'd have a glass of tea, they would give him a Christmas present, we did not consider him any different than us. There was no distinction. We are Jewish and he is not. And this was one of the first shocks as it relates Christians with whom we lived on a daily basis, with whom we dealt on a daily basis. Little did I know what was in store for me later as concerns former friends and neighbors.
What did he want to break into your house after this?
He didn't have to break in, just walk in and help himself, right. But he was honest enough to tell us. And he also knew that we are not people anymore. You see, we don't count anymore. He does not have to give any account to anybody. There's no law. There is no rule. There is no friend. There is no neighbor. There is no past. There is no relationship. Hefkerut, we call it in Hebrew, which means total anarchy and total disrespect, and the word would be irresponsibility, total irresponsibility. So now we are the big action, July 42, and there's talk about prior to July 42, we knew it was likely to be a big action. What was happening was one morning we open up the doors or the windows, whatever it is. Of course, every night that we slept, you know, somebody was always on guard, and many nights we just slept downstairs in the basement. One morning we woke up and we heard there's a lot of noise, a lot of commotion outside in the streets, a lot of horses, a lot of dogs. Something is strange. We look out in the streets and we see an awful lot of people, and we recognize some of these people from the villages from around us. And sure enough, somebody, a relative of my mother's who lived in a village close by, came. What happened was, as we later knew they did with us, and as we now know from the histories, from the eyewitnesses, from everything else, at the time we didn't quite know it. What they did was, they would gather up the people from, let me give you for instance, assuming Newark is my hometown. Wilmington is somewhere where the prison was that they took my father. Philadelphia, and I often refer to Philadelphia as Lvov. And conversely, when I speak about Lvov, I say Philadelphia. Somehow, I don't know how or why.
The
sizes and the distances.
I relate.
Right. The colleges, the universities, they are in Philadelphia, you see. There was no university in my hometown as it is in Newark, but there was a high school, and that was considered already a good proportion of a town. Assuming the Germans are here, and so what would be a smaller community than Newark? Elkton, right? I know of Elkton. So they took the people from Elkton to Newark and from all the surrounding little whatever developments around Newark, into Newark. Then from Newark and Chester and whatever else is around Wilmington, they would be taken into Wilmington. Then Wilmington would be taken into Philadelphia. Now Philadelphia would have a concentration camp. Wilmington would have a ghetto. Philadelphia, of course, would have a ghetto. And the ghetto would be where the former Jewish section was, okay? Because that's where the Jews naturally were, and this is where all the ghettos were. In my hometown, they didn't even bother making a ghetto. What we saw one morning was that the people from the surrounding villages were there, but they parked them in the town square with their belongings, which were like bags that they brought on their shoulders. Some of them came on, of course, there were no buses, subways, buses or trucks or any such thing. There were wagons. Horse and wagons. So they came on horse and wagons, but unfortunately, from many places, there were no horses and no wagons, but the Germans with the dogs were chasing them. And so they went miles after miles and fell on the way, and whoever didn't fall on the road made it, maybe to our town square. I remember one day I opened the door and I saw a German chasing a young gypsy with a dog. The dog was running, the young gypsy had to run as fast as the dog ran, and the German was on a motorcycle. So the dog, the gypsy or the Jew had to run as fast as the motorcycle went. Of course, which only meant as far as you make it. That you cannot run indefinitely, you cannot run as long as the gasoline lasts in this motorcycle. You will run as long as you will run. By the time these people from the surrounding villages made it to my hometown town square, I would say they were decimated. They had fallen by the roads, shot, beaten.